Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is Times Union reporter Casey Seiler, state editor of the Albany Times Union and co-host of New York Now. Welcome, my old friend Casey.
Alan, good to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Delighted to see you here. Okay, Albany corruption. What's the fix?
Oh, if only I had that written down on a prescription pad. It depends on who you ask, isn't it? Is it more disclosure of campaign contributors?
More phony disclosure.
Well, yeah, more phony disclosure. We're getting more in the way of granular disclosure. Actually, we're talking on Wednesday, which is the day that candidates and public officials and others have to turn in the much more granular disclosure forms to the Joint Commission on Public Ethics.
Now, as you say, much more.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can't fool me. I've been around a long time. I'm over 70 years old. I know this stuff keeps coming and coming and coming. So what do? They set up a system which says, okay, you got to say if anybody gave you money or whatever between this amount and that amount. Why can't we have somebody gave me $1,562 and they always insist that it's this between stuff?
Well, you're right. But the difference here is that as kind of a compromise between the really lame income brackets that we had before and the kind of exact figure that you're talking about, the brackets are much narrower and more informative this time around. So, for example, in addition to knowing how much, for example, just to pick a name out of a hat, Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver makes as of counsel at Weitz and Luxembourg, which is a prominent personal injury law firm, we will also know who, if any, his clients are at that firm. The same for any other official who has kind of a client relationship with a prominent business interest or a not so prominent business interest.
Casey Seiler, you know how much I respect you, but come on,
what's
going to happen here is people are going to say, well, he made between this and this. Their eyes glaze over. Whereas there's a reason that they insisted that the actual amounts would not be given. Believe me, Andrew Cuomo would have loved to see that because he would have gotten a lot of credit for it. No, they insisted because they know that, first of all, very few people actually go and look at that stuff except reporters, right? I mean, how many average citizens? But a lot more people would go.
More private citizens will look at it now because we won't have to go to, for example, the Legislative Ethics Panel or something like that to get these forms. They will be posted, and I think it's going to be in July. They will be posted on the J. Cope website. So
J. Joke or J. Cope?
Well, but once again, that's a matter of opinion. But, you know, it will be a much more effective tool if the public does want to take the time to go into it. Now, will teenage kids start doing it when they get home from school? Probably not. But it will be available. The information will be out there. But to get back to your original question.
You sound like a defense lawyer for these guys.
Not at all. Okay. Not at all. I'm just saying.
We are setting up a thesis-antithesis thing,
and you are arguing that it's largely worthless, and I'm arguing that, well, certainly not the solution.
I didn't say totally worthless, but I think if they wanted to do it, they could have done it right. But instead, they're still fooling with us.
Sure. Fooling, I think, is a word that's standing in for something.
It comes close to something
else.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Yes. But is it the solution to public corruption? If we have people who are lying, who are hiding business connections that are not on the up and up, that involve people who are also seeking political favor or political labors on their behalf, disclosure isn't necessarily going to do anything for that. For example, Eric Stevenson,
remind everybody who he is,
assemblyman from the Bronx, who was one of the first wave of arrests, was, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office, taking money from the operators of a series of elder daycare facilities to write and submit a piece of legislation that would have benefited his competitors by placing a moratorium on the construction of these facilities, I think, all across New York City. A bill that was never going to get passed, was probably never going to get passed in the Assembly, was certainly never going to get passed in the Senate. And yet he allegedly accepted, you know, under the table bribes from these people. He's not going to disclose that. That is the kind of corruption that is much more likely to be turned up by somebody wearing a wire. And apparently that is what his fellow Assembly Democrat member, Nelson Castro, who has retired sort of immediately after
these charges
story. Came to light. It's a fabulous story, but it's only the beginning
of
these kind of weeks of revelations that we've had.
So Castro, the feds knew that he was guilty, and he knew he was going to have to get out after his term, but he still wore the wire for the feds.
Well, here's the amazing thing is that Castro, in the middle of 2009, was hit with a sealed indictment on a perjury charge that stemmed from a case of election fraud from his first run in 2008. So then he went to go work for the Bronx District Attorney. The Bronx District Attorney, we can only imagine that he was then deployed against other borough officials. And then the Bronx District Attorney apparently then offered him up to the U.S. Attorney's Office, which then deployed him around the Capitol for at least 3 years. So that essentially means that while Castro was representing the interests of his district, he was also working for the U.S. Attorney's Office. You know, we always, in the newspaper, when we present a lawmaker's name, it's always D or R hyphen, you know, wherever, Mount Kisco or what have you.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, you could make the argument that it was Assemblyman Nelson Castro, D, U.S. Attorney's Office.
That's very funny. And, of course, as soon as this all went public, he had to get out of the way. So tell me about this. This is so fascinating, Casey Seiler. One of the things that is so good about this is that the paranoia level at the legislature is incredible, because all of these guys who ever talked to Castro or to any of the other guys who were wearing wires,
including Shirley Huntley,
who's
a lawmaker
she's 74 and going to jail for how long?
A year and a day.
Yeah. And that's only because she helped the feds a little bit.
Well,
not enough.
But didn't help them enough. What we know is that Shirley Huntley, who is facing charges of essentially helping to raid a not-for-profit that she helped set up and then falsifying some documents to kind of cover up that raiding, then offered her services to the U.S. Attorney's Office and wore a wire against a number of elected officials and a couple of Democratic Party operatives, including a large number of her fellow Senate Democrats, including John Sampson, subsequently arrested on different charges by the U.S. Attorney's Office.
He took a real haircut.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Oh, no. I mean, the charges against Sampson are really amazing. And I guess it's worth pointing out that they don't directly go to his public service, but the level of kind of criminality is really quite something.
There was a joke there. Sampson haircut. Remember?
Oh, I'm sorry. That went right over your head. Samson, not Sampson.
Yeah,
but
gotcha.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I took a little liberty.
There.
I know. But it was a good one. You're right.
Okay. And here is an interesting question, which is that in Plunkett of Tammany Hall, Plunkett says, the old ward healer says, there is legal and illegal wrongdoing. You know, in other words, how stupid do you have to be to take cash for doing something, including somebody who you'll remember who was indicted for $1,000? I mean, he sold the whole career for $1,000.
Right. And that's the amazing thing, is the level of stupidity that seems to be on display here, especially with the charges against Malcolm Smith, who once again was accused of attempting or has been accused of attempting to bribe Republican Party officials in the hopes of getting what's called a Wilson Pacula certificate.
Is it Pacula or Pecula?
Pecula. Pecula. I guess you're right.
No, I've always loved that name.
Yeah, well, of course, and you must remember that Alan Pecula directed All the President's Men, and it's Wilson Pecula that is the name of the certificates.
Oh, so, perfect. It's a good way to remember it.
Yes. But anyway.
Well, we digress.
Well, we totally digress. But the idea that Malcolm Smith could have been the first Republican mayor of New York City is ridiculous. You and I have a better chance of being the first African-American Republican mayor of New York City than Malcolm Smith does.
Okay, so sometimes, I don't know how to do this, but there have been those who have raised eyebrows because many of the people who are now the subjects of all these investigations come from a particular demographic subset, to wit, many of them are black. And this is not good. for many people who believe that what has to happen here is we have to have, and the Justice Department insists on it, more people who are representative of their demographic group. And yet, this has happened. There's little talk about it, although some have mentioned it. Does it mean anything?
No, I think is the short answer, although it has been raised already by some minority lawmakers, including in the Senate. And you're absolutely right. This wave of arrests all include minority members, most of them African-American. And the point has been raised by Ruben Diaz Sr., who's a senator, who says, you know, are prosecutors going as robustly after lawmakers who come from other ethnic groups? James Sanders, who is also a Democratic senator, actually co-hosted a seminar, a debate, you know, arguing, is this conspiracy on behalf of the prosecutors or is it corruption by those who have been targeted? And I do not think that race is at all a factor in these investigations. You are getting a lot of African-American people caught up because you're getting a lot of minority members wearing wires. And who, if you're a minority member who is facing federal charges and you go to the U.S. Attorney's office and say, I can expose corruption among my fellows, who are you going to call up to get into your office to get on tape? If you're from the South Bronx, it's probably not going to be, just to pull a name out of a hat, you know, Dave Valesky, who is a white upstate senator. It's not going to be a Republican from the Adirondacks. It's not going to be somebody from out in Buffalo, most likely. And also, you have to remember that the prosecutors we're talking about here are Loretta Lynch, who is African American, Preet Bharara, whose family goes back to the Indian subcontinent. And they're all working for the U.S. Attorney General, who, of course, is Eric Holder, who is African-American.
As is the president.
Yeah, right. Who works for Barack Obama, who is African-American as well. So I think that's kind of a defensive crouch that a lot of minority lawmakers fall into. But I don't think it's a particularly helpful or illuminating analysis.
Well, you're a terrific reporter, Casey Seiler. And one of the things that I keep hearing these guys are, when they get caught, are saying things like, hey, we don't even know who we could talk to because, you know, this is repressing our ability to do business.
Well, to get back to the question that we began with, what's going to stop these? And perhaps if the argument is the total paranoia is total awareness, is the assumption that whoever you're talking to is wired going to stop potential corruption in its tracks? That's not a bad one. The idea that whoever you are talking to might be wired up by the U.S. Attorney's Office is a pretty good deterrent to doing things that you'd rather not want broadcast on a radio station such as this one.
We are talking to Casey Seiler, state editor of the Albany Times Union, one of the brightest guys we know, and co-host of New York Now. Okay, so Casey, there was a time when Andrew Cuomo becomes governor of New York when I had the sense that everybody who wasn't him was, you know, to be warded off. So we had Eric Schneiderman, the attorney general. We had the comptroller, Thomas DiNapoli, who he had, I believe, Andrew Cuomo had an unthinkable animus towards. But I see that things may be getting a little bit better right now. For example, Andrew Cuomo just appointed a new committee that would help localities.
He hopes to. Yes. It's got to be done through legislation.
Right, right. And on it are all these old enemies that he used to fight with. That's interesting, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And what we're talking about is a financial advisory panel. Sure. That would essentially go around the state and act almost as kind of paratroopers for communities in fiscal distress. In other words, if their reserves had dropped low, if their tax rates are very, very high as a percentage of the value of the property in that community. And as you noted, it would include either the officials themselves or representatives from the Attorney General's office, the Comptroller's office, the Secretary of State, and someone from the private sector, from the business community. And the governor announced it or offered the most detail that we've had so far in a red room appearance down at the Capitol with a lot of officials from unions and from local leadership, the Conference of Mayors, that kind of thing. As noted, it's got to be done through legislation. But what the governor said is that these localities, if they accepted the kind of aid, be they loans or grants, to potentially bail out or at least assist some of these communities, they would have to accept as binding the recommendations of the panel. And those could include service consolidation or wholesale consolidation of, you know, in here in Albany, we talk a lot about the idea of the county and the city merging, which would assist the city, which has, you know, large infrastructure costs, but not necessarily the tax base to support it. So if you own a house, you're paying a pretty penny here in Albany. And it is clearly meant as a way to aid upstate cities, which are kind of facing an existential crisis where their tax rates do not support their service costs, which in many cases are very high, and also to rebut the criticism that the governor is getting from Syracuse's Stephanie Miner and others who say that the governor needs to do more to lead on some of these issues. The panel would also have the power, if uniformed services, meaning mainly police and firefighters, and the localities agreed to it, to serve as a binding arbitration panel in contract disputes. And that has been a very controversial issue. The current binding arbitration statute expires in June. And so we're on that issue, we're kind of headed towards a cliff. So it's going to be interesting to see what the legislature does with it.
What is the Triborough Amendment?
The Triborough Amendment is the amendment to the Taylor Law that says that the provisions of an existing contract with certain labor groups remain in effect while contract negotiations are ongoing. It's the Taylor Law that says that those labor groups do not have the
right
to
strike. No, you're not allowed to strike, but as a compensation for not being not allowed to strike, the last contract is in effect.
Is in effect while you're negotiating.
And, of course, the sort of pro-business groups and others hate that because it doesn't bring the civil servants to the table.
Correct,
So is there any chance that that'll be changed?
No.
Because the assembly will never change it, right?
The assembly will never change it, and the governor has essentially said that it's just a non-starter. And it's a non-starter for many Republicans as well as many Democrats because of a lot of down on Long Island where a lot of Republicans have a large degree of labor support. They're not going to go for that either.
So let's talk tactless now, as the old Governor Cuomo used to say. Let's get down to it. We have a governor who, without any doubt in my mind, wants Republicans as a break on social policy to stay in power. But we have more Democrats in the Senate altogether. But four of those Democrats have broken off and are now the so-called, you know, Independent Democratic Caucus, IDC conference.
Right.
And the way we heard about this remarkable arrangement was when they made their deal that they would be in power for 2 weeks and that the other guys would be in power. The regular Republicans, Dean Skelos, president, would be in power for every 2 weeks. Now we see something like...
Well, but that's only for the kind of ministerial function of Senate temporary president. They're both always in power.
Yes,
so.
But we've been seeing Dean Skelos, who got sort of rooked on the gun law, which was unacceptable to many of his regular constituents, now saying, we're not going any further on some of these things like the women's rights package that got put together by
Specifically the abortion rights plank in that agenda.
That got put together by the governor. Now, at what point does this governor get a little hell for not bringing all the Democrats in, say, you guys are in the majority, I want to run for president at some point, they're going to hold me responsible for arbitrarily keeping the Republicans in power in New York State?
Well, he took hell for it when it first occurred. He took hell from the rest of the Senate Democrats, the mainline Senate Democrats we often refer to them as. He took hell on MSNBC and in the pages of The Nation. And
not that it counts for a lot. Took hell from me and still is.
From you as well. But here's the thing. I would argue, and I put this in my Sunday column, that what would have happened if that coalition, if the IDC and the Democrats had come back together back in December, where would we be today with
all the indictments?
Yes, with two members. Because let's do the math, okay? Even if you add up the mainline Republicans, the IDC breakaway faction, you've got 33 members, okay? 33, you would have 30 Republicans and 33 Democrats in the state Senate. Now, today, two of those Democrats, John Sampson and Malcolm Smith, are currently under federal indictment.
But they're still sitting there.
They're still sitting there. They can vote. But here's the thing. When you are facing federal indictment, your range of interests narrows, and it narrows specifically to staying out of the federal pen. We've seen before how lawmakers who are under the sword of criminal prosecution really kind of lose interest in being lawmakers. And also, you know very well how transactional politics can be. Do you want your majority to be dependent? And if you're a governor, do you want your agenda, the passage of your agenda, to be dependent upon the votes of people who are facing federal indictment?
Yeah, Casey Siler. Coulda, woulda, shoulda. It could have been. But in fact, when the governor did it, he didn't necessarily know.
Wait, when the governor did what?
When the governor set up his little jerry-rigged scheme.
I think that is supposition on your part. There are no fingerprints. I'm not saying it happened. I'm not saying it didn't happen.
I'll
but there are no fingerprints.
I'll give you that. I think you're right. The governor, in fact, knew that some of these characters were suspect when he was attorney general.
I think Jeff Klein, who's the leader of the Independent Democratic Conference, knows it even better than the governor does because he used to be the guy in the room with many of those same people. He understands
Just to argue this with you,
okay.
There are those who believe that those four white guys who left that conference did it because they were unsatisfied with the fact that their own progress as potential leaders was hampered by the fact that there was a group of black and Hispanic people who were sitting at the top, and these four white guys who became the Independent Conference didn't like it.
Granted.
In other words, racist or racial instincts?
Well, I think they're kind of realist instincts because you're right. Going back to David Paterson, the leader of the Senate Democratic Conference has been African-American, and that goes back more than a decade easily.
But even David Paterson had trouble with some of these guys.
Yeah, but I don't think their problem, I don't think Jeff Klein or Diane Savino or David Valesky or David Carlucci, who are the charter members of the IDC, I don't think their problems were racial. I think they looked at that kind of analysis of where the next leader was going to come from, and that's what they saw. But I think it was more personalities than race that caused them to get out. And I'm not saying
you said
that
I think, but you don't know, and I don't know.
Well, I don't know what's in Jeff Klein's heart. And I know, knowing what I know about politics, is that everything is a mixture of a wish to do good, a wish to do well for yourself, and a desire to get paid, as it were, whether in political coin or actual coin.
Well,
so
I love having Casey Siler as our guest here. He's terrific. The state editor of the Albany Times Union, co-host of New York Now, the television show. Casey, thanks so much for joining us. We hope you'll come back often.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org, and NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decision to end sexual violence with the My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.